This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, commentary, and analysis from a Black Left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, Blacks in the South American nation of Colombia defend their rights to communal lands, a demand that whole categories of people be released from U.S. prisons, and the Black is Back Coalition is developing a national agenda for Black self-determination. But first, the FBI has stepped up its sting operations against Muslim Americans to implicate them in plots against the United States. Civil liberties organizations say almost every so-called terrorist plot between 9/11 and the year 2010 was in some way assisted or even cooked up by the FBI. We spoke with Sue Oudry, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee. She says most of the FBI's cases involve entrapment.
It absolutely is. There was a study done a couple of years ago by the Salaam Project and the National Coalition to Protect Civil Freedom that analyzed about 400 war on terror cases between, I think it was 2003 and 2010, and they found that only four of them did not have a component of FBI informants and entrapment of the people who were eventually convicted of terror plots. So yeah, it's a huge element of their war on terror, and it's certainly not ethical, and I would question its constitutionality also.
And of course, it's deeply embedded with racism and Islamophobia and all of these ills that especially afflict American society. And yet the Obama administration is not accused of being shot through with Islamophobia or racism, although it's the most active purveyor of these so-called anti-terror policies.
Right. It's disappointing beyond words how the Obama administration has regularized and institutionalized the racism and Islamophobia of the Bush administration's war on terror. And while both Bush and Obama claimed that they would treat Muslims no differently, the fact on the ground is that Muslims are overwhelmingly being spied on and monitored and targeted by federal, state, and local police. It's undeniable.
And in fact, the FBI has recently has bragged about the effectiveness of these kinds of policies and essentially said it's going to continue and increase them.
Yes. And a couple of years ago, when Attorney General Holder was still in his position, he was urging European countries to follow the United States' lead of using this technique of basically targeting, I would say, a vulnerable member of the Muslim community. If you look particularly at the Newburgh 4 case, an FBI paid informant infiltrated a poverty-ridden community, Newburgh, New York. He attended the mosque. He found some men there who were at best aimless. Some of them, a couple of the men definitely had mental and emotional challenges, and they all definitely had financial challenges. And this informant came in and waved money in front of them and took them for rides in his fancy car and gave them jobs and convinced them, after haranguing and hounding them, to engage in a plot to bomb a synagogue, which the men claimed they never intended to actually do. They just wanted to get the money. But it's a pattern that we see over and over and over again, and it's inexcusable.
And in fact, earlier than that, in Liberty City, a neighborhood of Miami, the FBI sent in a provocateur, and they wound up with a case against a bunch of very poor, some of them homeless men, accusing them of plotting to bring down the Sears Tower, the nation's tallest skyscraper, a task for which they were not financially, intellectually, or logistically suited at all.
Absolutely. And it's something that's worked well for the FBI. It allows them to grab headlines that they have come in and heroically foiled a terrorist plot. And it also allows them to beef up the statistics. It allows them to say, look at all these terror cases that are plaguing our country, and we really need all this additional authorities to wiretap and to infiltrate and to spy on the Muslim community. So it's a win-win situation for the FBI, and it's no wonder that they use this tool. But people need to be aware of it, and we really need to be voicing our opposition to the way the FBI is operating.
And these sting operations have had an effect on the way that the law is interpreted. That is, how does one show motive for committing a crime? You point out that folks who express outrage over the atrocities that were committed by U.S. troops at Abu Ghraib, or over the detention center on Guantanamo, or over drone attacks, that those kinds of sentiments then can be used to show a motive for some kind of act of terrorism.
Right. So it's an old trick of the FBI. They really don't like dissent in any form, and never have and probably never will. So when people voice political dissent from the status quo, the FBI is right there, and that's what they latch on to decide their targets. And then it also plays very well in the courtroom if they tape somebody making statements of outrage about U.S. policy. That's easily interpreted in the context of the war on terror. It's easy for the jury to interpret that as anti-Americanism and therefore something a terrorist would say.
That is, political dissidence as a, on its face, motive for crime.
Right. And this is part of our history. So it's nothing new there. And it's actually interesting. Another thing that my organization has been tracing and trying to rise up is the way that the FBI is actually using these entrapment stings against environmental activists and peace activists. And so it's something that they're using very broadly in the war on terror against the Muslim community, but it's also a trick that they're using against environmental and peace activists.
Yes, we remember, for example, that the police put forward the theory that Mumia Abu-Jamal's previous membership in the Black Panther Party could be used as proof of a motive for murder.
Right, absolutely. And, of course, you see that echoed in the Black Lives Matter movement, where police were saying that activists in the Black Lives Matter movement, that shows that they hate police and are willing to kill them. And so police are scared for their lives. So it all comes around again and again and again. They don't think of new things. They just perfect old strategies to use against people who are rising up and trying to seize power.
President Obama likes to call himself a constitutional lawyer. Actually, he has the degrees to prove it. But most constitutional lawyers look out for the rights of individuals. What kind of constitutional lawyer would you describe President Obama as?
Not a very good one. I would not want him to be defending me on any free speech or Fourth Amendment matters. Yeah, he has really turned his back on key provisions of the Bill of Rights in order to pursue this war on terror, and really also a war on dissidents and journalists, truth be told.
Well, what are your organization's immediate plans to combat this, not just the FBI's sting operations, but the administration and the Congress's attitudes, the prevailing encroaching attitudes in terms of individual rights and people's freedom of expression?
Yeah, you know, the Congress has been absolutely absent and unwilling to hold the administration accountable in so many different ways. We have a campaign that we launched earlier this spring asking the House and Senate Judiciary Committees to launch an investigation into the FBI's infiltration into activist groups. We know that the FBI and actually the Department of Homeland Security also were monitoring and infiltrating Black Lives Matter. They monitored and infiltrated the Occupy movement. They've been very active and engaged in monitoring and infiltrating groups that are fighting fracking, both locally and nationally. And we also know that the FBI spent 10 years infiltrating the School of the Americas Watch. So we are working with representatives of all those different movements to lobby Congress to get them to actually launch an investigation, because we don't even know what other groups the FBI has been focused on and trying to undermine. We're fighting to hold Congress accountable for their lack of holding the administration accountable. And we really do need an investigation. So we've got a letter that we sent with 60 peace and justice and civil rights groups in the spring demanding an investigation. And now we're up on the Hill lobbying and hope to get at least the House Judiciary Committee to hold a briefing, at least, on the way the FBI is abusing its counterterrorism powers.
Are you at all encouraged that civil liberties will be a real issue in this presidential election season?
You know, it needs to be, because as bad as Bush and Obama have been in refusing to respect the First and Fourth Amendments primarily, Clinton or Trump, you're giving these people who are potentially very dangerous are going to be walking into the White House with so much more authority thanks to Bush and Obama, and the ability of either one of them to be able to crush movements that are fighting their policies is just, I think, unprecedented. And I think we have cause to worry. If you don't think Obama was exploiting his authorities, just wait and see what either of the presumptive nominees will do to our civil society. It's really frightening.
Well, Bernie Sanders will say that he's not out of it yet. Has he provided any encouragement during his campaign?
You know, it hasn't really been a focus of his campaign. And when he was in the Senate, he's been good on civil liberties issues. He hasn't been a real leader, but he's been a generally pretty dependable. And I don't mean to discount where Bernie might end up or be able, what he might be able to accomplish. We're not a political organization, so we can't endorse or say that we like a candidate more or less than any others, but I would particularly fear a Clinton or Trump presidency.
And I'm sure there are certain powers that be in government that have duly noted your answer.
Indeed. You know, the Obama administration has just really honed so many tools for hurting Muslims, for targeting Muslims. In addition to this entrapment scheme, the stings and entrapment that they've really, doubled down on, they've launched a program called the Countering Violent Extremism Program that specifically targets schools and social service agencies and health providers, telling them to be on the lookout for signs of radicalization among youth. And their signs would be things like being Muslim or being an environmentalist or being an animal rights activist and caring too much and being too passionate about an issue. And this is something brand new with the Obama administration, and it's got us very concerned. There's just no end of ways that government is really targeting Muslims and dissidents, and it's just very concerning.
It sounds like a way of asking community members and even family members to spy on each other.
Exactly. And spy on them not for breaking any laws, but for exhibiting independent thought. So it's tagging people as potential terrorists based on their political or religious beliefs, not on any criminal activity.
Which sounds like the trademark of a police state.
It sure does. It sure does to me, too.
How can folks get involved with the Bill of Rights Defense Committee?
Well, people can visit our website, and we do support a grassroots movement around the country to mobilize folks to fight for our rights. And our website is the initials of our organization, Bill of Rights Defense Committee, so BORDC.org.
That was Sue Oudry of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee in Washington. The Black is Back Coalition for Social Justice, Peace, and Reparations is preparing to hold a national conference in Philadelphia, August 13th and 14th, to begin the process of crafting a national Black political agenda for self-determination. Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela explains.
It is a national Black political agenda for self-determination because this comes immediately from the April 9th conference that the coalition did in Harlem, New York, on the 2016 election and the struggle for Black self-determination. And one of the things that was striking to us when we had the discussion around the 2016 election is the fact that unlike that period of really serious struggle in the 1960s that we continue to reference, the African community is without any kind of even broad and general ideological position that we are tethered to. And so we find ourselves having to pray that the Democratic Party is going to treat us well and that the Republican Party is not going to treat us badly. And there is no basic political demand that's coming from the African community at large. And we felt like it would be really important for us to establish our own agenda that's akin to the kind of agenda that was represented by the presence of people like Malcolm X and forces like the Black Panther Party and the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, where the demand was for black power. The demand was coming from Malcolm, said that the ballot or the bullet, it was not an issue of feel the burn or all out for Hillary or Black Lives Matter. There was a completely different perspective. And even though they came from different organizations and sometimes political tendencies, the drive was for self-determination. And that's been a really important missing element in the political discussions up to now.
Well, how did self-determination go missing over the decades?
It went missing essentially because the United States government waged an incredibly brutal war without terms against our people and our community. They killed Malcolm. They killed Martin Luther King. They murdered at least 30 members of the Black Panther Party. They killed the co-founder of the African People's Socialist Party. They jailed people all up and down the line. Members of the Republic of New Africa, just in a whole assortment of people, were jailed and pushed out of commission, many in prison up to now, and many have been pushed into exile. Our organizations were, most of them were destroyed, the membership dispersed, and that left the field open for a host of opportunists, and many of whom you characterize as the misleadership class. This was their opening. This was the thing that gave them full control of the narrative, obviously at the behest of the rulers of this country. And that's the thing that we are contending with at this very critical moment in history, where masses of people are clearly struggling, searching to try and find some direction, but do not yet have the confidence nor the kind of organizational wherewithal to express a general opinion that's coming from our community. And that's what this National Black Political Agenda for Self-Determination that comes from the Black is Back Coalition is striving to achieve.
I remember, and I'm sure you do too, during the early part of Obama's second term, elements of the current black misleadership class, the NAACP, the Urban League, and other civic organizations said that they were busy coming up with a national black agenda, but nothing came of it.
But that's one of the problems, because I think Obama and the Democratic Party were their agenda. I think that continues to be their agenda. I think whatever comes from the Democratic Party has been what represents them, and especially with Obama in the White House, that consolidated everything. So it served to silence any kind of challenge that they may have made against the status quo. They joined with the status quo in the form of Obama and obviously the Democratic Party, and they will drive the masses of our people into that same camp. They have contributed to that. And sometimes, unfortunately, many people who we saw in the past as leaders of an alternative kind of politic, a militant black nationalism, or sometimes even black communists, found themselves acting with the same kind of patriotism that we see being exhibited across the board for America because Obama was the candidate and then the president.
Even as we speak, organizations are claiming to represent 16,000 black elected officials and other groups have convened in Gary, Indiana, to come up with, they say, a national black political agenda.
Indeed, that is the case. And I think it's striking when you look at the fact that so many of them are black elected officials. And what is really interesting to me is that we participated in a very serious black revolution of the 1960s that ultimately was defeated. And when you look at what has occurred since that time, the number of black elected officials who in office now, I mean, there may be up to 10,000 black elected officials and four times as many Africans who were appointed to offices, et cetera. But in actuality, the material conditions and political situation for African people, black people in this country, are worse today than they were in 1972, the anniversary year of the thing that they are doing in Gary, searching for this black political agenda, this coming up soon. So in many ways, they represented a consequence of the defeat of the revolution back then. And today, right now, it's clear that they are representing the efforts of the Democratic Party to secure the black vote, the black participation, to get Hillary Clinton elected as the next president of the empire.
Yes, why today? The black misleadership class, headed by all these elected officials, have been in the catbird seat in terms of politics in the black community for decades, and now they're talking about a political agenda.
Yes, they have to talk about it now. In part, you can call me paranoid, but I feel like in part it's an attempt to preempt a real black political agenda for self-determination from emerging. You note that they do not make a claim that what they are seeking is a black political agenda for self-determination. I think that's an aspect of it, but the truth of the matter is that Hillary Clinton is in the fight for her life politically. And there is this Trump phenomenon that has radicalized and mobilized millions of white people, and with at least a third of the Bernie Sanders supporters saying that they will never support Hillary Clinton, at least a third, and some of them with the potential for supporting Trump. I think they are moving forward now to solve this problem for Hillary Clinton, because if the black vote does not come out for Hillary Clinton, and they are even looking more and more, political pundits, at the actual numbers of the white electorate, and through reexamination based on the Trump phenomenon, they are talking about there are enough white people out there to elect Trump. So I think that it's the election that has mobilized them. I should say it is the Democratic Party and Hillary that have mobilized them and given them their marching orders and instructed them to come up with an agenda that can be supported and adopted by the Democratic Party and Hillary Clinton. I think that Hillary Clinton would have an easier time adopting an agenda that comes from these guys than she might even have adopting an agenda that would be influenced by Bernie Sanders.
And we should note that the same Democratic Party attempted to absorb the Black Lives Matter movement, or at least individuals in it.
Indeed. And I think that's something that we have to really be aware of. And this is a problem that we're trying to resolve with this conference that we're dealing with to establish our own national black political agenda for self-determination. Because if you don't have your own agenda, what happens is that you will end up being fodder from whomever it is has the agenda, has the organization that serves their own interests. And I think that was even a problem that we were having with the hashtag Black Lives Matter phenomenon, because they couldn't make a demand. There was no agenda. And in fact, there is the well-noted example of Hillary Clinton in this discussion. I can't call it a debate with one of the leaders of the Black Lives Matter, hashtag Black Lives Matter persons. And she was demanding, tell me what it is you want. What are your demands? And he was saying, we don't want any demands. We just want you to know what's in your heart, or something to that effect. So that's the problem that we have to deal with, that our community needs to have its own agenda. It needs to have at least a generally recognized and generally accepted direction that we're trying to head in, so that we just cannot be misled and we won't be fodder for whomever it is that comes along. And even if people say they're going to remain in the embrace of the Democratic Party or any other kind of organization, they should be informed by what is in the best interest of this community, and it should be something that they would be able to pursue. And the thing about a national black political agenda for self-determination, it is something that could be pursued all the time, not just during the election season. And I think it's going to be important that this is a national black political agenda for self-determination that will be formally unveiled at our conference in Washington, D.C. on November 6th, just a couple of days prior to the election that will determine whether Trump or Clinton will be the next president of the empire.
Well, tell us about the process that will go into formulating this self-determinationist political agenda.
Well, the thing is that what makes me really happy about it, that it is being something that's sponsored by the coalition, and the various organizations and institutions of the coalition will have charge of this, and what will happen is that the coalition itself has a number of principles of unity and certain kinds of demands that have been made over the years and even founding documents around self-determination. And this can be a starting point that we want to send out to everyone, and then we want to sponsor and have ourselves and encourage others to have pre-conferences throughout the United States where people can, you know, we know that there will probably be conferences in Philadelphia and Chicago and New York and Washington, D.C. and New Jersey and Florida and Alabama, various places. And we've had people to join the coalition who are in Pittsburgh, strong organizations there, and St. Louis and what have you. So we can see these conferences using guidelines that we establish in the coalition. We can see these different organizations holding conferences throughout the United States that will be quite transparent, that will be based on principles of unity that have come from the coalition. And this process is something that will go on where we will have people able to contribute to the agenda in these various locations and hopefully make it possible for people who won't even be in those places to contribute to what the agenda should look like. Then these same committees would have a responsibility of organizing to get people to Washington, D.C. And Washington, D.C., every year, we have our rally, and then we have a march on the White House on the first day. And then on the second day, this is when the conference will occur. So we want to move people from throughout the United States, first to have these conferences, and then to come to Washington, D.C., where on the 5th of November, we will have the rally and the march on the White House, and hopefully people will bring their banners and bring their placards, and we will have people hopefully speaking from throughout the U.S. on this agenda as they understand it. And then after the march on the White House on the next day, on the 6th of November, we see that being essentially a splash party, where we will have pulled together a quality representation of this months-long process of consolidating a national black political agenda for self-determination and get the people who attend the conference on November 6th to recognize this as the national black political agenda that will inform our actions and struggles throughout the country henceforth.
Black is Back Coalition Chairman Omali Yeshitela. A leading prison reform organization is calling for a much broader presidential clemency policy, one that would release whole categories of federal prisoners rather than setting people free on a one-at-a-time individual basis. Mark Maurer of the Sentencing Project says what's needed is big, bold actions like President Gerald Ford's clemency for draft resistors back in 1974. However, the Obama administration went into court to prevent the wholesale release of people convicted under the old crack cocaine laws. As a result, thousands of federal crack cocaine prisoners remain incarcerated. Mark Maurer wants a much more categorical approach to clemency.
Well, yes. What we need clearly is to both change the sentencing laws going forward from here so that we don't impose excessive punishment, and also to provide clemency in appropriate cases. To be fair, the Obama administration was very supportive of the Fair Sentencing Act that was passed by Congress in 2010 that reduced the scale of the disparity in sentencing between crack cocaine and powder cocaine. It didn't eliminate the disparity, but it reduced it. And then Attorney General Eric Holder was quite outspoken about that. The problem is, though, that that law was not made retroactive. And so today, about 5,000 people are sitting in federal prisons having been convicted of a crack cocaine offense that took place before the law changed. So justice concerns would suggest that this is a very appropriate group to give an across-the-board sentence commutation. Essentially, the president could resentence them as if they had been convicted today, so they would be sentenced under the current law, not the previous one that was widely considered as unfair and unjust.
But of course, the administration chose to go into court to argue that the law should not be interpreted or treated as retroactive, and thereby treated that category of convicted persons, thousands of them, as a group.
Well, yeah, that had to do with the date of conviction and some issues around that. You know, the administration, as I've indicated, has been supportive of the change. A number of the individual commutations that the president has given out over the last year have been for crack cocaine offenses. So that's encouraging, but, you know, the scale of what needs to be done, the scale of drug offense incarceration in the federal prison system is huge. And that's why we would advocate this very broad categorical approach to the problem.
And describe some other categories of prisoners who should be given a special kind of clemency.
Well, one type of drug charging is what's called the stacking offenses. Basically, several offenses committed within a short period of time that are considered individually, not as a group. So one of the more well-known cases was that of a man, Weldon Angelos. He was a 24-year-old music producer in Utah. Within the space of 72 hours, he made 3 marijuana sales to an undercover agent. During the course of sales, he possessed a gun hidden in his sock. He never used or threatened to use the gun. He was charged with the 3 marijuana sales, and as a prior felon because of the first conviction, in possession of a weapon. And under the terms of federal mandatory sentencing policies, the judge was obligated to sentence him to 55 years in prison for essentially 3 crimes that took place over the course of a weekend. So there could have been discretion used in this case to just treat this as if it was one offense, in which case he might have been sentenced to 5 or 10 years in prison, still not a slap on the wrist by any means, rather than have them stacked together. So there are many cases people in federal prison today, as a result of this stacking, are getting far greater sentences than their conduct would suggest they deserve.
The United States is so far ahead of the rest of the world that to get down to the levels of incarceration of 1970, which is about when the modern period of mass incarceration began, to get down to that level, we'd have to release about 7 out of every 8 of the people who are in prison today. And we couldn't possibly do that with these piecemeal, one-by-one consideration clemencies.
Well, exactly. And even if there's an expansive clemency program, you know, the federal system over which the president has jurisdiction incarcerates just a small fraction of all the people in prison, less than 15%. And clemency is very important. It's been very underused, but it's also an after-the-fact action that presidents and governors take. And it's no substitute for not addressing the problem on the front end, which means we need sentencing reform to have more rational sentencing policies. We need more diversion from incarceration. We need more public health approaches. You know, if we really want to address mass incarceration, it's going to take much more on the front end than just rectifying some of these problems 5 and 10 years after the initial sentence has taken place.
Now, you use the 1974 President Ford amnesties for draft resisters as a model, but there's one thing that stands out about that 1974 decision, and I remember it quite well. Most of those draft resisters were white.
Exactly. And, you know, that was the height of Vietnam War resistance. There was a major campaign. Many individuals did resist, and the vast majority of those were white who benefited from that policy shift. That doesn't mean it was the wrong thing to do. I think it was very reasonable for Gerald Ford to issue that clemency, but it does raise the question about how and when do we make consideration of addressing excessive punishments. It's encouraging that Congress in 2010 scaled back sentencing for crack cocaine, which has been applied overwhelmingly to African-American defendants. But we see over and over again in the justice system, whether intended or not, policies and practices that have a disparate effect on people of color in the justice system. So true justice reform needs to involve both reducing the number of people in prison, but also aligning that with a focus on reducing racial ethnic disparities as well.
Yes, Gerald Ford's 1974 amnesty was not wrong, but it was much easier because most of those affected were white. And so that amnesty does really not address the black mass incarceration aspect, as you just explained.
Right. I mean, clearly we need to make a range of changes in policy and practice. You know, some of this is changing sentencing laws. Some of it is changing the culture around incarceration. You know, decisions made every day by policing, by prosecutors, judges, parole boards, who may not believe that they are engaging in any biased decision making, but study after study reveals that bias does come into play at each stage of the justice system. It doesn't mean that every black defendant gets a worse deal than every white defendant, but overall, race plays a role in these outcomes, and we need to address it at each stage of the system.
Yes, people have periodically brought up the idea of mandatory racial impact reports to show how various laws and the enforcement of laws, the racial impact of those.
Yeah, we've been promoting the concept of racial impact statements, similar to an environmental impact statement, which is widely used now in public policy, with the idea being we should project the impact of a law before it's enacted rather than afterwards, because there often may be unintended consequences that come out. So for sentencing policies that legislators are considering, we should have a racial impact assessment. How would this new sentencing law affect racial ethnic groups? Would there be disparate effects? And if there would be, then how do you come up with policies that can ameliorate those impacts? Three states to date, Iowa, Connecticut, and Oregon, have passed versions of the racial impact legislation. And essentially, it's designed to stimulate the conversation about race proactively, not just bemoan the problems that develop after the fact. The most clear-cut case in which that could have been used probably is with the federal crack cocaine mandatory penalties back in 1986. I think anybody at the time could have predicted there would be a very disproportionate effect on African Americans, and that's exactly what we saw. And it took 24 years to finally scale back the severity of some of those penalties. So we should have had that conversation about the racial effects back in 1986. It shouldn't have taken 24 years to finally come up with a partial remedy to the problem.
And so any presidential clemency policy by category should be informed by things like studies of racial impact.
Well, exactly, it should. I mean, clearly clemency should be correcting any injustice. Injustice can take place in a variety of ways, a variety of populations, but we should just make sure, the executive should make sure, that certain categories of people are not being prioritized over others. Certainly what President Obama has done to date, because his commutations have been almost all for people convicted of drug offenses, given what we know about the hugely disproportionate racial effect of federal drug offenses, it turns out the vast majority of the people who have received clemency to date have been people of color. So we just hope that that focus continues as the president, and we'd encourage governors at the state level to be doing the same kind of approach.
Blacks in the South American nation of Colombia joined with indigenous Colombians to block roads in protest of encroachments on their land by multinational corporations and threats by death squads employed by the rich. Ajamu Baraka is a Black Agenda Report editor and columnist, a founder of the U.S. Human Rights Network, and also a member of the Afro-Colombian Solidarity Network, a U.S. coalition that advocates for the rights of Black people in Colombia. Baraka says Afro-Colombians also have conflicts with FARC, the guerrilla force that has been fighting the Colombian government for decades and has its own plans for land reform. Baraka explains the complexities of the conflict.
Well, what's happening in Colombia today and over the last almost week now has been a national mobilization on the part of Afro-Colombians along with indigenous groups to escalate their tactics in response to what they feel is an inadequate response from the government to their demands that the issues that they are concerned with that are being discussed as part of the so-called peace process in Cuba have not been addressed, and that they have not been offered an opportunity to participate directly to ensure that their concerns are addressed. And what are some of those concerns? Well, one of the main issues that they want to make sure they address is this issue of land tenure, this issue of who controls the land and what kinds of activities will take place on the land. One of the planks that is being discussed between FARC and the government is on this issue of land and who controls it and what kinds of activities will be allowed. They want to make sure that their voice is part of that conversation, especially because both groups have collective title to land. And if there are any agreements that will result in a commitment on the part of the state to push for individual land ownership and individual land agricultural production, then that contradicts the development processes and the social values and principles of both of those groups. So this is a very important issue, and they felt like they have not had their demands adequately addressed, and therefore they are demonstrating to the state, to the government, that they have to be brought to the table or economic activity in Colombia will not be allowed to go forward in a normal way.
And so the Afro-Colombians are demanding to be included in those peace talks in Havana. But who is opposed to their inclusion? Is it the government or the FARC guerrillas or both?
Well, it's the ones who have the main say-so would be probably the state. But, of course, it's a complicated situation. So there's even some pushback from FARC in terms of where they are going to stand on these issues. I think that they believe that they are representing adequately those concerns. And, of course, they have their own organizations that they will argue represent the interests of both of those groups. So it's on both parties' part. It is part of a complicated discussion. But if the state took the position that is part of the conversation, they wanted to make sure that the talks were broadened to allow for the participation of groups that have a direct relationship to what's being discussed, I think the folks are pretty confident that FARC would not oppose that.
Well, of course, Afro-Colombians have lived on those lands for centuries and the indigenous peoples for much longer than that. But those claims have actually been recognized by the government and codified into law and agreement, haven't they? The problem is enforcement of those agreements, isn't it?
That's true, that there's been some recognition on the part of the state to collective ownership of various lands. But as you have spoken with people from Colombia and know, there's not been the kind of robust enforcement of some of the very same procedures that the government committed to engage in when it comes to issues like economic development and what kinds of companies will be allowed to participate in those territories and what kind of economic activities they're going to be engaged in. For example, one of the issues that both groups raise is that the government fails to engage in consultation with the groups when it enters into contracts, into relationships with various economic interests, mining interests, agricultural interests, that is corporations that want to come into a territory and to engage in certain kinds of economic activities. Those companies will pretend to engage in consultation with the groups, but usually that process is a bogus process. And when these groups then raise that issue with the government does not respond adequately, or the government itself will skirt those requirements to engage in prior consultation with these groups and pretend that that's been done and will go forward with their whatever agreement they are working toward with those corporations. So, yeah, enforcement has been an issue. And as you also know, that even when there is prior consultation, we have the issue of paramilitarism. When you have these corporations engaged in nefarious relationships with groups on the ground, bandits, criminal gangs, if you will, to have these groups to, in essence, enforce or to advance their interests through intimidation, violence, and even murder. So you have a particular kind of predatory capitalism that takes place in Colombia and in other parts of Latin America, where you have this relationship between corporations and the government and these paramilitary forces that will do the bidding of these corporations in terms of clearing people from land, terrorizing and murdering local organizers in order to advance the interests of their clients. Except that in Colombia, paramilitarism has been taken to a new art form.
So we have multinational corporations encroaching on Afro-Colombian lands, and we have the state of Colombia backing up those corporations. But the paramilitaries that you're talking about, Colombia claims that the paramilitaries have been discontinued, have turned in their weapons, and are no longer an active force.
Yes, of course, and that's the argument that they make. They reluctantly will recognize that there is some activity, but they will claim that it's not at the level that it was before, which is partially true, but it is still a national scandal and a national phenomenon, and the government is quite aware of that. But because of the complicated relationships between various governmental figures and corporations and the paramilitary forces, many people in Colombia will argue that the government has not moved aggressively enough to finally deal with these paramilitary forces. And the other fact of the matter is that the government also knows that they exist because the government has been forced to provide some degree of protection to some groups, some individuals who find themselves at the receiving end of these death threats. Very expensive operation where they provide armed guards and transportation and other things to these individuals. And the number of Afro-Colombian leaders that are moving around because of those threats with these armed guards and this and that. So, you know, it's a ongoing problem. The state is aware of it. But one of the issues that the insurrection, if you will, is involved in raising, this national strike, that is, this last week or so, is actually demanding that the government take a more aggressive stance on these paramilitary forces also.
A death threat in Colombia is about as serious as you can get. Colombia is the world leader in political assassination, tens of thousands of people.
It really is, and so they have to be taken seriously, and the state is not even in a position to provide protection to all of the individuals under threat, and it definitely doesn't have the resources or really even the political will to protect various communities that find themselves on the receiving end of these paramilitary forces. So these are the kind of issues that is being raised. The Afro-Colombians and the indigenous people say that basically if the state took a principal position to allow for these communities to develop along their own lines, if the state took an aggressive stance to help to clear out the paramilitary forces, if the state protected and lived up to their commitments to allowing for these groups to control their own territories, that would go a long way in eliminating the violence and the issues of poverty and all of the other issues related to development in Colombia and the ongoing crisis. But those demands have to be made and respected by the government.
There have been at least three deaths among Afro-Colombians at these strikes and blockades of roads. How did those come about?
As a consequence of the heavy-handed response from the special military forces, they have a special police unit that is tasked with the responsibility of dealing with protests. So the response has been relatively heavy-handed, the activists will argue, and as a consequence of that, we've had some deaths, some people losing their lives. And that's been raised. It was raised last week. It was raised when the Afro-Colombians first went out on strike more than a week ago and had to face rubber bullets and tear gas, and it continues.
You're speaking as a member of the Afro-Colombian Solidarity Network. Tell us about that group.
The network was put in place to provide support to the struggles inside the country, primarily directing its activity toward the U.S. government because of the close relationship between the government and the Colombian government. So the network is tasked with the responsibility of educating the American people on what's happening in Colombia and the role of the U.S. government in supporting Colombia. It is tasked with the responsibility of attempting to advocate on behalf of various groups inside the country, that is inside Colombia. It sponsors educational tours of activists from Colombia into the U.S. So it is part of a network of support for the various movements and the human rights situation within Colombia, something that is really important, especially, again, because of the tremendous amount of resources and tremendous amount of influence that the U.S. government has with the Colombian government through its Plan Colombia program and its longstanding ties with that government.
Yes, many Americans, including Black Americans, don't even think of Colombia as being a largely Black country. About what proportion of the population would we consider Black?
Well, the activists will argue that they represent almost a third of the population in Colombia. Of course, race is a very complicated situation in Colombia, but it's clear that even with those folks who may have some racial ambivalence, Colombia represents the third largest population of Black people outside of Africa. You have Brazil number one, the U.S. number two, and Colombia number three. So the fact that few people, in particular Black people in the U.S., are aware of this fact is one of the areas that we are trying to concentrate on with the Afro-Colombian Solidarity Network's political education work, to let people know that when they hear about and think about Colombia, they can't just have in their mind an image of mestizos, that they need to think about and know that there are large numbers of Black people in Colombia. So when they hear about labor organizers being murdered or hear about struggles around land, then they need to be understanding that what they're hearing about is probably folks who are also Black involved in those kinds of struggles.
Reverend Edward Pinckney, the imprisoned community activist from the mostly Black town of Benton Harbor, Michigan, believes his life is in danger. Pinckney is serving a sentence of 2.5 to 10 years following his conviction by an all-white jury on the flimsiest charges of tampering with an election recall petition. He told Kenneth Rhodes, a supporter on the outside, that he's not afraid of the inmates, but fears the government is out to do him harm, and that they might get away with it because, in his words, they cover everything up at Marquette Branch Prison, located on the thinly populated and very, very white Upper Peninsula of Michigan, almost 500 miles from Benton Harbor. Pinckney, who is 67 years old, has witnessed numerous assaults on inmates by prison guards and has spent long stretches in isolation. For 6 months, he was deprived of phone and visitation privileges because the authorities believed he was behind a mass inmate food protest, another bogus charge, since inmates at prisons on the Upper Peninsula have been protesting the food since before Pinckney arrived. This is the second time that Pinckney has been railroaded to prison for trying to bring change to deeply impoverished Benton Harbor through the vote. Back in 2007, after two trials, an all-white jury from the surrounding county convicted him of tampering with a ballot petition. He was sentenced to house arrest, but was then thrown in prison for a year when he quoted Bible verses to the judge, something of a first in American legal history. Ultimately, the conviction was overturned on appeal. Reverend Pinckney's lawyers believe his current conviction on similar bogus charges will ultimately also be reversed, but that could take years, and anything can happen to a political activist in the American prison gulag. Mary Neal, who calls Reverend Pinckney her online minister, believes the people of Flint, Michigan, would have responded to the poisoning of their water supply sooner if Pinckney hadn't been incarcerated at the time. The Reverend has had more experience than most other activists in dealing with state-appointed emergency financial managers, like the one that switched the water supply in Flint. Benton Harbor was put under state dictatorship in 2010. Governor Rick Snyder then quickly expanded the emergency financial manager regime to all of the state's heavily black cities, effectively disenfranchising more than half of Michigan's black citizens. But Reverend Pinckney and his Black Autonomy Network Community Organization, or BANCO, pressed on, refusing to accept the loss of their local voting rights, either to the state of Michigan or at the hands of the giant Whirlpool Corporation, which has ruled Benton Harbor like a plantation for generations. Finally, they sent a SWAT team to arrest Reverend Pinckney at his home in April of 2014, and now he sits in a cell in the American equivalent of Siberia, a 67-year-old soldier in the African liberation struggle.
And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Be sure to visit us at blackagendareport.com, where you will find a new and provocative issue each Wednesday. That's www.blackagendareport.com. It's the place for news, commentary, and analysis from the Black left. I'm Nellie Bailey, along with my co-host Glenn Ford. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network.
You've been listening to the Black Agenda Report on the Progressive Radio Network. Information for liberation.